we crossed the border, we had no power. I think we've a bit of power now.
Our mission was to show that we're no longer the whipping boys of Munster.
Hello and welcome along to this week's episode of Warriors, the GA podcast for you, the 42 members. I'm Fintan O'Toole and today we're focusing on Dublin football, a fairly common topic that seemingly crops up every September in modern times. But instead of talking about a recent All-Ireland final, today's focus is going to be on the sporting times of Bernard Brogan. Now, Bernard has a new book out. His autobiography, The Hill, has been recently released with Kieran Shannon, who you might know from a past episode of Behind the Lines, the sports writing podcast for you, the 42 members. The book is published by Reach Sport, and it's a really excellent read into a career that I think had more setbacks to it than people realise. Bernard obviously won plenty All-Irelands and All-Star awards. He was the Footballer of the Year in 2010, but he had two major injuries when he tore his cruciate, while also faced a pretty big battle over the last couple of seasons to get some time on the pitch with Dublin. So we got chatting about all that with his recent involvement during Jim Gavin's success as Dublin manager, the early years with Peter Caffrey as he was trying to make a breakthrough into the Dublin senior ranks, the relationship he had with Pat Gilroy, the rivalry with Kerry, his famous family background and their history in Dublin football, and a lot of other playing memories besides, as well as touching on how the GA is possibly going to have to adapt in this COVID-19 world. So let's crack on with it then. It's episode 25 of the Warriors podcast with Bernard Brogan.
Kieran Kilkenny. Dennis Bastic couldn't hold back. Kieran Kilkenny back on it. Now Bernard Brogan with the snapshot, kicking into Hill 16, nailed it.
This year, maybe one of the things in the lockdown, people said that they were going to complete projects, get something done, and you've done one of them. You've brought out your autobiography, and you completed the book telling your, I suppose, your life story, but a lot of it obviously is focused on your time as a Dublin footballer.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't planned for a COVID release, but it actually probably worked out okay that we were locked down for the last part, because it's a very humbling experience, and it was really amazing to relive some of the memories and even have some chats with some past players and past colleagues to relive some of those memories for the book. But then the last couple of months of it are it gets heated up, and we had a deadline and we're working towards that. And when you're trying to proofread a book and do all this type of stuff, it adds up when you have two babies at home and everyone's locked down. It was a challenging couple of months, but an enjoyable experience, but
I guess this was always going to be a strange year for you, in that it was your first year having stepped away from the senior into county scene. Has it been a bit stranger as a retired player, the fact that there's been no action at all? I mean, you hear of a lot of guys say they're bracing themselves for that moment where they go back to watch the team in action again. I mean, I don't know, did you get to a couple of the league games, but you're still waiting for that sense, I suppose, of watching a Dublin team in championship.
Yeah, obviously been a weird year for lots of reasons, and been an entrepreneur and having my own businesses. My mind was consumed with trying to keep them alive and afloat and get after opportunities and pivot and innovate and all the good stuff you have to do in a crisis. So it's in that way my mind has been occupied with that, and obviously with my two lads at home, being able to spend some time with them has been great. Even during COVID, there's the silver lining and everything. I feel so. It was great to be at home, seeing them at their kind of as they're kind of starting to explore the world and start running around and discovering the world and diving off things and stuff. So that was good. But I think now coming into, please God, we'll see football shortly. I'm hoping that the championship gets up and away. I think they've managed club set championships well, the GA. So seeing the rugby get up and away and finishing out the European Championships and the Pro 14 and stuff like that, that it's given us hope that there will be a championship. So I think that's when it probably will hit home. And not been there on match day, buzz of it, you can't feel that emptiness, I suppose, or that hole, that buzz of match day when you're driving down from the Gibson Hotel, maybe down through Fairview and seeing the guys outside the bar and driving into Croke Park and seeing the flags waving and the jerseys on Clonliffe Road and into a running out of the tunnel into Croke Park and the crowd going wild. And I don't know if there's nothing that will ever feel that hole, but I kind of was well prepared coming into it. I obviously probably should have been gone a few years ago at my age and where I was at, but obviously hung in there to try and help the team along the journey. So in that sense, I was ready to go, and I definitely couldn't give any more to the group. I left no stone unturned for what I could add. So in that way, there's a sense of kind of accomplishment or a sense of time enough, I suppose, that I could do no more, and I can walk away and proud of my contribution, I suppose. My time when I played a lot on the pitch, but even in my time where I didn't play as much, but I still tried to help the team where I could.
The timing of your retirement probably came at maybe a natural sense of, you know, end of season. It happens for a lot of players. I guess it's just been interesting over the last week. You've seen a guy you've been very close to, Darren Daly, has retired. Obviously a sign of how, I suppose, different the season has been. And even just this week now, we've seen Colm Kavanagh, someone you'd come across a lot. So I guess it's been a forced upon decision maybe for a couple of guys that you'd have known pretty well in terms of their moving on from the game.
Yeah, I think as you get a bit older, the body dictates more than the mind sometimes, as I've had encounters with. So, but you know that he was moving well and getting back to where he wanted to be, and the body kind of injuries started creeping up on him. And the long years with that, I'm sure it's the same for Colm Kavanagh, trying to keep yourself at a peak and obviously training early on the year, doing your pre-season, coming into COVID and gearing up for a meaty National League campaign and gearing up for the summer, and then trying to keep the body in the right place and keep the mind in the right place over the summer, obviously with everyone had their own challenges through COVID, and now kind of re-gearing up for the championship. It's difficult on the mind, but very difficult on the body as well to maintain that level that they need to be at. It's such the game has gone so physical now. There's so much mileage done on the pitch that the body has to be able for that. And I'm sure I hadn't read much into Colm Kavanagh's yet of his retirement, or I haven't seen a statement, but I'm sure he's a great soldier, and he was a guy that lived on manic energy and got up and down the pitch and did a great job. So I'm sure his body was speaking to him. Obviously, I'm sure no inter-county player wants to hang up the boots, but for eventually, sometimes time runs after you. And for Butsy, he's a guy that was understated in many a time, but was a massive part of the group. He got a couple of key moments in our Ireland finals. I remember the block he had on Tom Parsons 2016, I think, in the last kick of the game to help us win by a point, you know. So 7 All-Irelands under his belt, he's a guy that can walk away proud of his innings. But yeah, it's been a tough year like that. I'm sure there's loads of other people that are probably questioning stuff, trying to figure out, do they have the motivation or the body to get after this championship in the way that they probably should. So it's tricky for players. It's very difficult, you know, to try and keep themselves tuned in all year, you know.
A lot of the Dublin players used to talk about Darren Daly's role as kind of being a very valued member of the squad. And maybe that's one of the things we didn't realise from the outside. You know, maybe we looked at the kind of star players like, say, Conor Callaghan over the last couple of years. But what was going on in the layer below that? It seems like that's one of the themes you kind of wanted to kind of push in the group. And like, I think one of the interesting things is you talk about in 2010 yourself and Owen O'Gara, you're kind of the full forward line stars, and then you kind of have a different role kind of pushing each other on in the last couple of years. And you kind of give a very good insight into, I suppose, what the life of an inter-county player in a senior squad is like at that maybe stage of their careers.
Yeah, and it's when you're not playing as much, you have to try and find your energy from different things and your motivation. But fundamentally, as you say there, with the likes of a Butsy, Darren Daly, and anyone kind of around the group, when you're away from the lights and away from the media, away from the limelight, it's a group of lads that are going to show up for training and trying to work hard and push each other and raise the standards. And the rung below the superstars are the guys who are showing the goods on the pitch week in, week out, are as important, especially for the culture that Dublin had, is that next group of guys, the fringe players, the guys that are going to come in and finish off the job, the finishers, as Jim would call them, they're as important, because when we train those 15v15 games, or when there's an environment where guys are motivated to push each other, that means that all ships rise and that you set a standard that kind of raises all boats. And that's what Dublin have had over the last 8 or 9 years is that we've had a competitive environment where if people are playing well, they get a chance or they get a jersey, and that's what drives those internal games and the standards. And we all know about the legendary Kilkenny ones. It's the same thing that if you can have an environment where people feel if they're playing well, they get the jersey, you're going to just get absolute war on those 15v15 and the age old stuff is you train like you play, and that's a fact. If you train at an intensity that's very high, that comes into your games, your ball handling is better, you're dealing with stressful situations of when you go point behind or go down, all this stuff. It's lessons learned, you know, from training field.
There's probably maybe a perception out there that, you know, your career was, you know, you were at the top for so long. I mean, I think you tweeted a while back about the actual title of the book, that as well as pointing to Hill 16 and playing in front of the fans, you kind of wanted to give us, I suppose, an insight into the climb you had to endure. Like, there's a line in the book where you say, I think someone had said you were a natural, and you were kind of keen to point out, you know, the work you'd had to do in terms of kind of skills and all that. Was that something that has always been on your mind, or is it kind of more maybe since you kind of got into this process that you wanted to kind of maybe illustrate how much you had to work and bide your time, I think, in particular, maybe early on under Peter Caffrey?
Yeah, you're dead right. I think, when you have a bit of success and Dublin are going well, everyone thinks it's always been easy and times have always been rosy and stuff like that. And I think, my personal journey has been plenty of disappointment, plenty of not setbacks, and having to go to the well and cash in that resilience that maybe I had intrinsically. I made my debut at 23. Obviously, had a kind of a sharp kind of few years where things were going well. I got Player of the Year a couple of years later, and we had a great run with Dublin. But then, since for the last 3 years, been around, I have fought tooth and nail to try and get any game time. After I think that Kerry game in the National League final where we were beaten, I think that was the last kind of game where the management kind of believed in me, I think, as a player, maybe, or maybe a little harsh, but definitely saw me as a starter or saw me as a key man on the team. And from there, it was me trying to prove myself. And it's very difficult to do that when you're a bit older, because the management and players and teammates have seen you at your best and seen what you can do. And when that trust or that belief that you're not able to do that is fading because of age or whatever, or a series of games, it's very hard to change that mindset, that unconscious bias that I was saying to Jim, like, you can't judge me on my age. If I'm playing as good as a Conor Callaghan, or I'm playing as good as a Cormac Costello in training, like, you'd give them the opportunity. If I was in the jersey, you have to give me the opportunity, you know. And that's one that's hard for a manager to do for people that are getting a bit older. And maybe I just wasn't up to it at that stage. But for me, as a high performance athlete, I believed I was. And if I didn't believe that, there was no place for me there anyway. So you always have to back yourself, and that's one thing I've probably been pretty good at, and is backing myself. And I on the pitch, I'd always didn't mind missing a shot and taking on the next one. I think you have to have that bit of self-belief if you want to try and be at that top standard for a period.
I suppose one of the most interesting things about your career is that you have a range of experiences to draw upon. I mean, there's a lot of the current Dublin team, largely they know life under Jim. Maybe some of them might have had underage teams with Desi, but it's, I think, revealing that you have three different managers to kind of refer to the experiences of. And you talk about kind of proving yourself to a manager. You seem to have a lot of enthusiasm to do that under Pat Gilroy. Like, you talk about when he was testing you, and I think it's, you say you're coming home in the car one night with Alan and Ross McConnell, and you're aware that this is happening. And like, you go into great detail, I suppose, about how he was testing all of you. I mean, those, like, I've heard bits of it, but when it's painted out in front of you, that kind of winter training regime that him and Mickey Whelan did, like, it sounds pretty grim what you went through. But obviously it was the making of you.
Yeah, and Pat was a great kind of people psychologist, or understood the individuals, and some people take beating with a stick and some people take an arm around the shoulder. And I was probably one of those people that was resilient enough to take that hammer, and I wanted to try and be the best, and Pat saw that there was more in me, and he just put me under pressure. And I'm speaking to Alan even about it, since the book came out, like, he put a lot of people under pressure, but obviously Alan was kind of saying that he felt that he picked on me maybe a bit more, because I was obviously marquee forward at the time, and he felt if he got the message through me, it would filter down to most in the group. about working hard, about teamwork, about working as a unit. Not that I wasn't trying to do that anyway, but maybe just getting some of that work rate and work ethic into the group that he wanted. He wanted that defensive structure that post-2009, he wanted to start Learwigs. He wanted to maybe set up a more solid base, a foundation of a team, and then build on it going forward. And that took hard work, and it took forwards working hard, getting back, creating a wall and creating a zone, a red zone, we used to call it, that you're trying to get tackles in. That stood to us. The more we did that, the better we played, the more possession we got. But yeah, he used to call me out a fair bit, but I got kind of rallied to that. Like, I've always tried to prove my critics wrong, and if somebody says I can't do something or I wasn't doing something well enough, I always try and prove them wrong. So that was the kind of, Pat probably saw that in me as my traits and my personality, and he said this is what he's going to go after. So he was a great leader like that, and understood how to get the best out of people.
He seems to have had an amazing ability that he could give out to you in front of the group, tear strips off you, and then sit down in the food with you. I think you talk about, was it one game, maybe it was against Armagh, I think, where he kind of said after the game to you and Alan, I really should have organised a night away for this. And next thing he goes up and he buys a round of beers for everyone. He just seemed to have that really ability to connect with the players.
Yeah, and it takes massive trust for a leader to have that, because on one hand, he'd take the head off you, giving out to you, and in 2 minutes' time, he could be sitting down chatting to you and telling gags. And I've given a good example before, but of his leadership, where he'd ring me before one of the sessions we were doing post the game, and he said he made a couple of bad decisions, that maybe shot from too far out or I didn't tackle or something, and he rang me and said, just let you know, I'm going to crease you over here in training, and just giving you a heads up just so you're aware, on the couch and catch on the bounce. And I was kind of going, okay, I've been here before, but he's bringing me in, he's bringing me on the journey. I'm obviously part of his trusted players, and he's opening up to me. So I felt empowered. I felt like I'm making strides with him. And then when he goes into the group and rips strips out of me, everyone's like, wow, that's actually, no man is an island. Everyone, like, no man can do what he wants. Everyone's going to be stripped down. So he got the message. He empowered me, and he empowered the rest of the team in the one fell swoop. You know what I mean? So that's powerful leadership in my view. And I always thought that example was a great one. His skill set,
like his input off the pitch. I mean, given the companies you're involved in now, I mean, you understand the kind of commercial and sponsorship world better than most. But it's really interesting when you kind of sketch out the scene a decade ago, and I suppose how he kind of overhauled it. And I guess maybe it's just interesting given what's going on at the moment now that the outlook is kind of so uncertain for sport, that there'll be kind of maybe similarly big changes needed to be made. But like, he was kind of central to that. I think you talk about his legacy, and it's those sort of stuff that I think that you think of maybe when you see the impact he had on Dublin football.
Yeah, and the commercial side, Pat saw, he was obviously a great entrepreneur and has been successful and sold a few companies now at this stage. As a young man, but he also saw the marketing appeal and commercial opportunity that Dublin GA had. Obviously, at the time, he'd one sponsor, maybe the marquee sponsor, I think it was Vodafone at the time, and he saw there so much more. But basically, he understood the commercial aspect, but he also wanted to provide the resource to the players. So we looked at nutritional food. Could we bring in a food partner to make sure that we are eating right away from the training pitch as much as we were eating right? So discounts on food, protein, Under Armour, and then skins and time, about our compression gear, our recovery, all of those aspects of the game that was going into that kind of professional nature, as in the way we trained. He was looking at how do we use our brand to actually provide an opportunity for all players to get these resources to make us better, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But also provide some funds to stand like Pat wanted for the team to stand on its own 2 feet, to be able to make decisions around training, to be able to do things, and not have to go back to the county board with cap in hand looking for stuff. And Jim, even more so, again, kind of believed in the same, and creating a fund where there's a couple of commercial activities that provides funds for the team to try and get after the things, and not having to go back to the county board. Like, in fairness, I know Dublin has all this commercial back and forth that they have with every other county, but Dublin have over 40 coaches in the schools, like, promoting the game, looking after the fundamental skills, movement skills of kids in school that are going to stand to them for the ages more than any other sport is doing in our national schools and across our communities, you know. So, and they're doing it in every county, but it's just obviously Dublin is bigger, so needs more bodies, so needs more money. Obviously, the bigger population can get more income because of more eyeballs watching or supporting a team. It's basic metrics like that. That's how the commercial world works, you know. But yeah, there is a big challenge coming into sport. Obviously, great. Please God, we'll see a championship, and we'll see football, and we'll all enjoy it. That means that the GA will obviously be able to activate some of their sponsorships. They'll be able to create revenue. Whether I don't think they'll get much revenue from selling tickets, the way the numbers are like in the coronavirus. So a sponsorship, viewership on TV will be up, I'd say, this time of the year, to have a bit of sport, the winter nights, the weekends. I think people will be more attuned to buy. See, the summer, there's loads of things to do. People are away on holidays. I think there'll be more eyes, more eyeballs on TVs, which might generate more revenue for the GAA. So there's other ways and means. It's about looking at those in business, like in Legacy and Pep Talk, we looked at the crisis. Well, where's the opportunity here? You know, well, where can we come out better? It's the same as an injury. When I did a cruise ship or got any long-term injury, I said, how can I come back better than I came into it? How can I be stronger? How can I be more better with my weaker foot? Whatever it is. And it's the same in business. The Legacy now, we're just coming out with a new business model. We're focusing more on digital. We're trying to look at a new space and add value to our clients. And Pep Talk is around, it's a platform around well-being and driving culture in organizations. And that's obviously a big thing now, especially in this remote world. So there's opportunity there on an international level for Pep Talk. So we've taken this opportunity or this challenge and trying to see where's the positivity in it. And I think that's the way I've always been. I've always been a glass half full type person, that more setbacks than most in sport. But always use them to get better. I remember Paul Galvin, just listening to him. He went to a GA club in the UK, and the guys were asking him, oh, how do I be better? What do I need to do off on the episode? He says, many people here have a bag of footballs, a bag of O'Neill's at home, and not one of them put their hand up. He says, there you go. He says, how can you be better than the guy beside you or the guy against you when you're doing the exact same as them on a Tuesday and Thursday night? And that kind of stuck with me, because that's what I did. I got a bag of balls. My dad bought me a bag of O'Neill's footballs 15 years ago for the house. We really square was a family and kick, and he was involved with Plunkett. So he just had a bag of balls. I wouldn't even say he bought them. He got them somewhere. But we went out and I spent my spare evenings kicking balls over the bar down the local pitch. Practicing when I did my cruciate, my right knee, I kicked only my left foot for the 6 or 8 weeks and the recovery stage of it when obviously the strike of a heavy O'Neill's ball wasn't nice on the cruciate. That's how I got better on my left foot and striking. I actually prefer striking on the run off my left than I do off my right, because that's what I practiced. That's the way I look at it, at a challenge. And every organisation, not just the teams or the GAA, every organisation should look at crisis like that and see how can we be better. Dublin have been good because year on year, they tried to innovate, or we've innovated every year. How do we be better? Teams are going to understand how we play. Teams are going to look at us. They're going to know who's our marquee players. They're going to look at the style of football we play, and they're going to come up with solutions for that. So if we don't come with something different this year, and it's not always something massively different every year, but over time you need to evolve, because people are always looking at you, especially when you've had success. People look at the most obvious one was when Donegal had the blanket defence. Like every team in the country was adopting a 3 or 4 man defence, and club games around the country were destroyed. And the whole of our games for a while, as in inside forwards like me, had a tough time for many a year. But people find a way of breaking it down, and that model has been kind of able to be broken down now. You know, so there's loads of learnings in it, I suppose, in a long winded way to answer your question.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. I suppose when you're talking about evolving, it's interesting in the book that you maybe talk about the way you evolved as an intercounty footballer. You know, I think you talk about the early days. You know, you were living with a couple of the lads in Ongar for a while. Then there was a time, I think you say, you described it like the clown car coming to training when Senan Connolly used to drive a few of you. But you also seem keen that, you know, the Pillar Caffrey era, that's the era that didn't get the All-Ireland breakthrough. But you kind of wanted to spell out the strides that were made there that maybe people wouldn't be aware of. And a lot of people would have seen that photo after 2011 when he was on duty and you went over to him. it seems that for all the frustrations you felt in the first couple of years that you weren't getting a chance with him, maybe with the passing of time, you kind of look in that phase of your career maybe a bit differently now.
Yeah, and I said, and it would have been easy for me to kind of to question Taylor's methods and all that type of stuff. And as I said in the book, he made massive foundations and made a massive strides forwards, as Tommy had done previously before him in different ways. Obviously, I wasn't privy to that group, and I know he gave Alan, he gave young lads a great, he empowered a lot of guys that come up and went on to win that All-Ireland, Barry Cahill's and Alan and Paul Casey's, young guys. But with Pillar's time, like, he really went at it professionally. I remember taking home like slabs of water and Club Energize and different things, just different angles, trying to hydrate better. We had the best recovery. We had strength and conditioning. The first bit of strength and conditioning we were doing in an organized way. He really kind of pushed us on probably as much as anyone else. There was probably nuggets here and there that were maybe left behind, and obviously I would have felt that I could have played a bit earlier, or there might have been a bit of there could have been a bit more of that empowering on the pitch type thing, and we were serving an apprenticeship. That was my only kind of cut. That was my only question. But I say that's what we learned from, and I've gotten to where I was without those hard days of trying to get into the team and push myself, and that was the reason I went away and started kicking footballs and trying to be better, because like I said, I'm going to have to be 10% better, 15% better than the other guys to get my chance. And those setbacks really pushed me on as an individual to get after these things. But yeah, no, Pillar, and that's that picture, and seeing Pillar in 2011 All-Ireland final, I think it was a nice way. And Davy Billings, a great late Davy Billings, who was a big part of Pillar's backroom team, and great dub, Vince's man. Yeah, like it's like everything, and especially Jim would always say, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and we would have met with different Dublin teams. And obviously, my dad in the bottom 70, so legacy is a big thing for me. And everyone adds something to the success. So none of that team, and why I kind of felt nervous about the book. Obviously, really opening a window into the group in some ways, but no silver bullet in that group. There's no bit of magic. There's no one nugget that any team could rob from me telling a story. It is a culture that's been built through challenge and through losses and learnings, and then into attitude and culture and positive kind of mindset, and layered and layered over time. And yeah, you need a bit of luck, and you got a couple of good groups of lads and good players together, like any good team gets in a generation. And we got that bit of luck of all these things coming together, and the team capitalised on that, getting the 5 in a row. But I think, yeah, it's important to understand the foundations were laid long before that 5 in a row that cup was built, you know, or was lifted.
Your first year that you kind of made the proper breakthrough, 2007, you talk about the joy of getting that goal in the Leinster final. And then you played Kerry in a game, which I think of all the Dublin Kerry games, it's maybe overlooked a bit, like as a neutral. It was a brilliant match, that 2007 semi-final. But you talk about the learning experience of marking Tomás O'Shea. I mean, it might get you to talk a bit about marking Mark O'Shea, because you've talked about how tough he was an experience. But you say that day against Tomás, maybe not many people would have realised that was a big learning curve for you, because he was at the kind of peak of his game then. And, you know, I suppose you later made your name as a corner forward, but that day you were wing forward. And it feels like the pitting yourself against the O'Shea's was a big thing for you.
Yeah, well, Dublin Kerry is obviously anything Dublin Kerry is big for me. My man been from there and spent a lot of my childhood there. And yeah, Tomás O'Shea is a legend of the game. I was looking forward to marking him, nervous and all that, but just to see how he controlled the game and the energy he had, my strength wouldn't have been my gas or my engine, my endurance. I was more of a short, sharp kind of guy. And the inside forward line probably suited me better. But I got a kind of a lesson that day from Tomás O'Shea about work rate and been tuned into the game. So all those little lessons, and you say about Mark O'Shea, like I love playing against NC O'Shea's. I loved marking the best. I would say that Mark O'Shea was probably my best defender I've ever marked, and we had loads of great battles over the years. Him getting the better of me most times, and I got the better a couple of times. So it was just his balance, but most of the times I got scores off him. It was over my shoulder and the turn type thing, and he's a very hard guy to stand up take him on and lose him, or when I used to get the ball and turn and try and lose him that way. He was a big lad, obviously, but his balance on the ball is, and he lets you get the ball, or else you get the fist down. If he went for the fist out there, he usually got it. Otherwise, he let you get the ball and you couldn't spin him. He had such good feet, and he was able to play football as well. So like he was wasting cornerback really, but I suppose he caused a lot of inside forwards like myself problems and kept a lot of them quiet over the years, which was probably to the benefit of the team maybe more than out the pitch. But he was a true footballer. The O'Shea's were great, and we've had some great battles with him over the years.
There's a great photo, I think, of the two of you after the 13 semi-final coming off the pitch. I think you've said it before that maybe, I think, was it 4 points you got that day? That the reason that they're so satisfying is because, you know, you had to work incredibly hard for each one of them, and because it was, you were playing against the pinnacle of defenders in your eyes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's when you get true satisfaction or something, it's when you've went to war and you've gone against the best, and that's what you pitch yourself. When you're trying to be of a high standard, you want to pitch yourself against the best and see if you get out on top. And but it was great respect. That picture is just respect from the two of us. I would never swap my jersey or anything like that. It's one of wearing that blue jersey is great pride of mine, and I would have kept a lot of my jerseys. And but that day I wanted to Mark O'Shea. There was one guy that I definitely wanted to share my jersey with, and that was Mark, because there was a massive respect there. And that day, it was just that picture was a nice snap that we'll have forever, I suppose.
Paul Flynn, different sort of performance from him today. Here's Bernard Brogan. McCarthy had got free. Bernard Brogan, that's right out of the sweet spot, and his eye is very definitely in.
In the Dublin sense, like the in-house training sessions, you kind of go into them in a good bit of detail. Was Mick Fitzsimons the kind of the peak to Mark in that situation? I mean, you talk about, it's quite interesting, the level of, maybe wouldn't have been aware of, like, how much players kind of approach each other for, you know, what am I doing right here? What am I doing wrong here? And even you mentioned a good bit when you had disappointments of maybe not making match day squads, you kind of gravitate to him and you'd still maybe do some kind of work with him. Was he one of the guys that it became key to kind of to test yourself against?
I would have, yeah. Mick had his own challenges getting in and out of the team. He's been around obviously since day one, and played a lot of football, but was in and out of the team for many a year. But over the last number of years, he's really just stepped up as the marquee cornerback and sticky. And I would have marked him a lot in training. And again, the reason you want to pitch yourself and see where you're at against the best. He's one of the most competitive guys that I've ever met, literally in any form of life. But he's humble as well, as in he wouldn't give you an inch in a competition. Well, if you're playing him in table tennis or football or whatever, he's just a competitive, very driven guy. But as I say, he's humble and he's eager to learn, and that's what true, really high achievers are about. They're effective, they're competitive, they'll cut you in half, but they are willing to learn and understand and try and be better every time. So he would have drove a lot of that. People in the group, I think there's a great sense of learning in the group now, and self-awareness and an openness to being better. People like Mick, Kevin McMinnum, lads who would approach players and say, how do we be better? Give me some feedback. What can I do better? And Mick, if I turned Mick on a training day and got inside him for a goal, or I caught a ball over him, he'd come up to me after and he'd be like, what could I do better there? Or I slipped there. He was just so analytical about his own game. And that's why he's probably gotten to the levels that he has. And a couple of all-stars he's gotten the last few years are well-deserved, and probably should have had more earlier in his time. He had a bit more game time, but I'd pitch him as one of the best cornerbacks from a man marking point of view, and that there is out there. And I always love going to battle with him, and I had a great sense of pride when he got his first All Star. And obviously, they're only small things, but it's nice for someone to get a bit of recognition for the efforts they put in and things like that. And yeah, when I wasn't playing as much, I'd try and get over to him and help him with the high balls, or to help him turn. I remember doing a couple of drills, pretending to be attack at him with like a Gini might do, or do different things that you might do in a game. So he's a great character.
Just finally, I guess the focus on the 2018 and 19 seasons, a lot of it is, you know, your recovery from injury and kind of the constant battle, I suppose, to win the hearts of the management, to kind of get on the pitch, to get the game time. You didn't quite get it, I guess, in terms of getting onto the pitch like you wanted for the Kerry game, but you still did obviously make the 26-man panel. And I guess there's an interesting contrast in your family. the way it ended for your dad, the way it ended for your brother. I mean, Paul obviously was very unlucky with injuries, but like Alan, I suppose, had the dream moment. But I guess it just kind of shows that not everyone kind of gets to bow out in the fashion that they did. But are you just overall kind of grateful, are you, that you were involved in the 26-man panel? Is that the overriding sense when you kind of look back on how it all ended in your final season?
Yeah, and I think I stayed around, as you said, till I was 35 or whatever I was at the end. So I was obviously long in the tooth. But I decided early-ish in my career that I'm not going to leave on the top or whatever they call it. I'm going to stay around as long as I feel like I can add value. And that's what I tried to do. Why there was a sense of accomplishment, I suppose, from getting into 26 is that I was retired the week before. The first game was there and the match went ahead and I was in the stand and I was basically retired because we all thought there'd be a winner or a loser that day, whatever way it went. And then obviously there was a replay and I just kind of just threw shackles off in one of the training sessions and kind of went back to normal or back to the way I would have attacked the game, which was just go at the players and try and get scores. And it's gas with Jim when I retired, he said, I wish I had done that 6 weeks ago. And I said, Jeez, you gotta tell me to play like I thought I was trying to play this pivotal role and bring people into the game, and I thought I was trying to add value. Yeah, we live and we learn, I suppose. But Jim brought me in and I believe him. I didn't get onto the pitch, but I believe that the game was tight and there's a point either way, but I probably would have got a nod to maybe do a job to take a shot or to get in there and try and manufacture something. So in that sense, there's a sense of accomplishment that I got back. As Jim said, I was exactly where I should have been at that time. You know what I mean? As in, I was there on merit, I was there on ability. My age didn't matter. I was there to help the team if needed. It wasn't needed in the end. We won by a couple of points, but that was enough for me. And that's what I mean. You'd say about the holes that would be hard to feel, about that buzz of 80,000 people in Croke Park on our final day, and that feeling you never feel. It's not when you can walk away feeling like you've done your bit and feeling you've accomplished the best you can, be it on the pitch or off the pitch. I think there's a sense there of achievement and relief that, yeah, I'm happy to go now, that my time has come and I can walk away proud of my efforts and not regret anything, I suppose. And that was the one thing I wanted to do, was walk away and not have any regrets. I think I did that.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a lot of effort and a lot of achievement chronicled in the book. It's my autobiography, Bernard Brogan, The Hill, with Kieran Shannon. Bernard, thanks a lot for joining us today on the Warriors podcast.
Finally, Paul Flynn kicks it long, hopefully in there, and it's in the net, and it's scored by Bernard Brogan.
So I hope you all enjoyed that chat with Bernard, and if you're new to the 42 membership, please check out our back catalogue of episodes, which recently has had the likes of Cork's Niall Callan on the county's 1990 double success. We had Zach Toohey from Laois in conversation with Nicholas Walsh on his AFL rise and his current involvement with Geelong as they're getting set for the finals of that competition next month. And we also explored the life and times of Tipperary hurling icon John Doyle. So thanks a lot for your continued support of the 42 membership, and as always to our producer Kevin Brannigan for putting this together. You can tweet us at warriors_GAA or at FOTool13 or email sport@the42.ie if you've any ideas for future episodes or counties or players you'd like to hear us cover. We'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, take care.
To the British Army, once we crossed the border, we had no power. I think we've a bit of power now.
Our mission was to show that we're no longer the whipping boys of Munster.